going to live the rest of my life. I realized that death is real. I mustn't waste time. I became much more dedicated to practice and study. Having this intimate experience of death helped me appreciate my life. We often conduct our life as though it's going to last forever. With this attitude, we want everything. The fact of death puts a limit on what we can have, what we can do. We don't need to think about death all the time, but to ponder it, to contemplate it, gives us perspective and inspiration about living our life. It also makes us less spoiled. It makes us look at the balance of our life and determine what needs to come first. What is important to me? How shall I use my life? We're able to enter situations more openly once we've related with death. It makes our love more powerful. 17. Samsara and Karma. Everything we experience, all the ups and downs of our life, is fundamentally encapsulated in the word samsara. Samsara is a wheel that is endlessly spinning. We think that life progresses in a straight line pointed in the direction of improvement. But in fact, we're in a circle of illusion that keeps us ending up just where we started. Karma, the action of cause and effect, is what keeps us here. No matter who we are, we're caught up in this process. Samsara always has to have the last word. We need one more thing to make us happy. One thing leads to the next, perpetuated by our desire to have final satisfaction. But the next experience feels uneasy, and we still need one more thing. We need to eat, then we need to listen to music, then we need to watch a movie, then we need to relax in a bath. The desire to feel satisfied is a continual process that drives our lives, and the end result is suffering. Samsara is not a sin. It's just what ends up happening when we're driven by negative emotions. What ends up happening is called suffering. From the perspective of the Buddha, we keep ourselves on this wheel lifetime after lifetime. The suffering of samsara exhibits itself in three particular ways: the suffering of suffering, the suffering of change, and all-pervasive suffering. The suffering of suffering is very basic. Even being born into this life is painful. We cry because we have to leave our mother's body. Then we're brought into a world of heat and cold. To some degree, we spend our whole life fortifying ourselves against these fundamental forms of suffering. Either we're putting on warm clothes to fight off the cold, or building shelters to protect ourselves from the sun. With the suffering of suffering, we just can't win. We're late for a meeting, we lock our keys in the house, we cut our finger trying to get back in, then we get stuck in traffic, and when we finally arrive, we discover that the meeting's been canceled. That's the suffering of suffering. Then there's the suffering of change. Whatever our object of pleasure, it changes to pain. We experience this kind of suffering when we fall in and out of love. We experience it when we eat a delicious meal at a great new restaurant, and then several hours later find ourselves in the bathroom with churning bowels and a stomachache. We experience it when the clothes we buy are no longer fashionable. We experience it when our own body, which has been our continual basis for pleasure, gets sick, falls apart, and nags us with its needs. This is the suffering of change. The third kind of suffering is all-pervasive suffering. It stems from the reality that nothing is solid, that everything is conditioned and in flux. At an atomic level, everything is coming and going all the time. Consciousness itself is coming in and out of existence hundreds of times in the snap of a finger. The world we perceive and how we perceive it is constantly changing. All-pervasive suffering is the inherent quality of this very process. no matter what we have, we can't fight the constant fluctuation and instability of existence. This level of instability brings mental agitation. The point of contemplating samsara is not to feel overwhelmed or depressed, but to wake up to what samsara is and stop being fooled by it. Then we can give up trying to outwit samsara. We can give up the attitude that one of our schemes will result in permanent pleasure. We can recognize samsara, rise above it, and emerge from it. When we wake up in the morning, we can tell ourselves that even though we'll experience suffering today, we don't need to be drawn into chasing our own tail trying to outsmart samsara. Samsara isn't a place. It's an attitude. I'm real and everything's for me. When we become aware of this attitude and what creates it, we can start to change it. What creates samsara is that we keep trying to get pleasure by engaging in non-virtuous activity resulting from bewilderment, fixation, desire, aggression, jealousy, and pride. This leads not to pleasure, but to suffering. Suffering is the karma of non-virtuous activity. Karma means action. In Tibetan, we say lay. We tend to simplify the dynamics of karma by saying that one thing causes another. However, karma is more complex than that. There are many causes to any one effect. Think of all the conditions that must fall into place just for us to drive to work. Good health, clothes to wear, a working car, no accidents on the way, knowing where the office is. Whatever happens is the result of many causes and conditions. Who grew the apple we eat? Who picked it? Who delivered it to the grocery store? Karma makes the world go round. We all want to be happy. No one wants to suffer. So the point of contemplating karma is to look at what causes and conditions come together to produce happiness, and what causes and conditions come together to produce suffering. Then we can point ourselves in the direction of happiness. If we're engaged in aggression and greed for the purpose of making our life better, the end result will be pain. If that pain leads to further anger and jealousy, we shouldn't be surprised. It's just karma in action. Conversely, actions based on virtues such as compassion, kindness, love, patience, and non-attachment lead to happiness. These are considered virtues because they elevate the mind above negative emotions. For example, if we practice non-aggression when we feel irritated with our spouse, instead of aggravating the situation with anger, we can resolve our differences peacefully and maintain harmony. Even though our patience may not be completely free of self-interest, nonetheless, acting with virtue takes us toward the mind of enlightenment. By exercising virtue, we'll eventually discover selflessness, emptiness, and luminosity. Acting from virtue leads to virtue, which leads to happiness. If we plant peaches, we're always going to get peaches. If we plant pears, we're always going to get pears. Karma works in just this way. If you plant non-virtue, nigewa, you get suffering. If you plant virtue, gewa, you get happiness. If we're using strong negative emotions to get what we want, and what we want is happiness, it's never going to work. Therefore, we need to contemplate our intentions and actions. Contemplating samsara and karma strengthens our intention to point our life away from suffering and toward true happiness. 18. Jumping into the heart of the Buddha. When we contemplate impermanence, illness, aging, death, and all the other aspects of our precious human birth, we see how fixated we are, how strong-willed and tenacious we've been about our version of reality. It's clear that this fixation has caused us suffering and pain. The more self-involved we are, the more anger, jealousy, pride, and other traumatic emotions we have. Whenever we seek more self-satisfaction, we end up with more suffering, from minor to extreme. In every case, the suffering results from some kind of selfish intent. We see that we've acted this way because we took our emotions, concepts, and thoughts to be real. Through the power of our meditation, we also see that these emotions are fundamentally illusory and empty. We've sat through hours of being angry and hours of being desirous, and at the end it was all like a dream. It becomes clear to us that this simple misunderstanding is working against our happiness and well-being. This is just what we need to open the mind of enlightenment. Clear insight into the dynamics of bewilderment and suffering. We have to understand the nature of suffering and the origin of suffering. Once we do this, we've got the perspective of an enlightened being, which gives us a window to the world. We see that everyone wants to be happy, just like us, and that other beings are also creating a tremendous amount of pain and suffering based on illusory experiences that they take to be real. We begin to feel a genuine empathy with the suffering they're experiencing. We want their suffering to cease. This is the birth of compassion. Compassion enlarges our heart. The Tibetan word for compassion is nyingje. Nying means essence or heart. Je means lord, noble. Compassion is having the mind of the noble heart. Those of the noble-hearted family are warrior bodhisattvas, who have superior view and intention because their hearts are big and courageous. They want to do something about others' suffering. Compassion gives rise to love. Love is the wish for others to be happy, for them to accomplish whatever their mind desires, whether it's material or mental, whatever they wish for in order to be fulfilled. This love and compassion is called bodhicitta, awakened heart. Because a mind that is enlightened naturally and unconditionally cares for the welfare of others. In Tibet, bodhicitta is called Changchub Sem. We can take this to mean, until all beings achieve the level of a Buddha, I will be courageous in working for the happiness of others. This expresses the motivation of the bodhisattva warrior, one who vows to develop his enlightened mind in order to help others. What the Buddha discovered is that we all have bodhicitta, ripe for nourishment. Within the bewildering maelstrom of thoughts and emotions that keep our sense of self solid, each of us already has the seeds of love and compassion. Bodhicitta is the radiant heart that is constantly and naturally, without self-consciousness, generating love and compassion for the benefit of others. It's a stream of love and compassion that connects us all, without fixation or attachment. It has a tender sadness to it, like a wound that remains eternally exposed. It's our true nature. Cultivating this quality will soften our future because, given the proper conditions, the enlightened mind will blossom like a flower. When this happens, we will be in sync with how things really are. The mind of enlightenment emerges whenever we find ourselves wishing for someone else's happiness without wanting anything in return. Bodhicitta is as big as that selfless moment when a parent would do anything to free a child of suffering. However, it can also be expressed in little ways, such as wishing that someone could have some food to eat or do well in their exam or work. That moment of delight and care is bodhicitta. It is our inherent awakeness peeking out like a jewel spontaneously arising from our open heart. It's our true wealth, a blessing that is always available. It can arise anywhere, in the middle of an argument, in the middle of reading a book, in the middle of a walk. Whenever we feel the wish to help a child, an animal, an old person, a friend, unconditionally, with no expectations, it also arises in the feeling of compassion. When we want the pain of others, the cut on their finger, the cancer they suffer, to stop. Throughout our lives, we've experienced bodhicitta, but in a fleeting way. Sometimes we feel vast unconditional compassion or love, but then it fades, like the sun coming and going, or a shooting star. It is very vibrant, but it dissipates quickly. It feels like an anomaly because we're not used to it. It might have popped its head out, but we squashed it back. We didn't have space for this tender, open, courageous warrior heart to grow, because there was only room for me, my concerns, my wishes. Now that our minds are softer, more pliable, the natural joy of our being can expand. In contemplating bodhicitta, we're trying to mold our mind to the point where extending unconditional love and compassion is our mainstay, our basic motivation. To develop bodhicitta involves a fundamental change of attitude. The point is to gradually change the object of our meditation from ourselves to others. Our mind has been so used to facing inward that it will take a transformation for it to face outward. In fact, our whole existence has been turned inward, so it is going to take some massaging to turn it around. This shift is sparked by seeing that the habit of always thinking of ourselves only keeps us unhappy. To extend ourselves to others is the route to true happiness. The point of this practice is that by feeling the love and compassion we have, we can make it bigger, with the aspiration that eventually, just like the Buddha, we will be able to extend our open hearts toward everyone we meet. To do that, we need to practice rousing bodhicitta regularly. As with all contemplations, rousing bodhicitta depends on a strong and stable mind. With peaceful abiding as our base, we can bring a feeling to our hearts and keep it there without distraction. In turn, as we contemplate compassion and love, we are strengthening our mindfulness. First, we feel the love or compassion we have now for someone close to us. We saturate ourselves in this feeling and then gradually expand our circle to include acquaintances, neutral people, irritating people, and eventually all sentient beings. With cultivation, this mind of bodhicitta will arise spontaneously with whomever we encounter. We begin our contemplation by resting in the open field of equanimity. With this attitude, we're letting go of fixed ideas of enemy and friend, which is our usual way of dividing up the world. We tend to have very strong opinions about who we love and who we don't, usually based on whether someone makes us feel good or bad. These concepts are changing all the time. A lover becomes an enemy becomes a friend. The good guys become the bad guys, and vice versa. We maintain this view in subtle ways. Even among animals, for instance, we think of sharks as bad and bunny rabbits as good, butterflies as beautiful and mosquitoes as obnoxious. Now we're going to let go of our opinions and level the playing field. We want to develop unconditional love and compassion for everyone and everything. If we focus only on those we love, rousing bodhicitta will become an exercise in attachment. When the Chinese invaded Tibet in 1959, everyone who could escape became a refugee. This included the Dalai Lama, other government and religious leaders, wealthy landowners, and the poorest nomads and farmers. When the refugees arrived in India, no matter what their social status had been in Tibet, none of them had a home. Everyone was equal. Ruler and subject, lama and monk, rich and poor alike had to make the best of being a political refugee in a foreign country. The field was leveled. To encourage equanimity, we can take the attitude that everyone we encounter, directly or indirectly, has been kind to us. The driver of the bus takes us where we need to go. People work at night so we can read the news at breakfast. A total stranger grew the potato we ate at lunch. Even someone who irritates us might give us the time of day if we ask. If we believe in reincarnation, a traditional way in which we can elicit the attitude of equanimity is to imagine that at some point, over many lifetimes, every single sentient being has been our mother. Every single being we encounter has offered us the unconditional love and protection of a mother, as we have offered it to every single being. The person sitting next to us on the airplane has in one lifetime or another been our mother or father, friend or child or sibling. The point of invoking equanimity is to release our attachment to opinions, to let go of our relative notions of like and dislike. With this attitude, we start as we are. We bring to mind someone for whom we feel tenderness, love, and care at this very moment. It could be our mother, our husband or wife, our child, a friend, or our cat or dog. The important thing is that when we think about this person or animal, our heart automatically goes out to them. One reason we feel love or compassion for this person is that they themselves care for us. We think of that person and our heart automatically gets bigger. Somehow they've brought joy, friendship, comfort to our lives. When we think of their kindness, we wish to repay it. Our hearts are already opened and connected. With no strings attached, we want them to be happy. We don't want them to suffer. So we begin our aspiration with what we wish for that person. I hope that my brother has a safe journey. May Diane's surgery be a success, or simply, may David enjoy happiness. We connect with the love and compassion that we easily feel. Accessing this immediate feeling makes a little crack in the hard ground around our heart. A beam of light comes out, like the tender shoots of a crocus poking through the ground in early spring. This is bodhicitta. We settle in that light, that growth. We rest there. We soften around it. We revel in it like a flower in sunshine. It feels refreshing and wonderful, and we only want it to grow bigger. More light comes through, more love, more care. We completely absorb ourselves in the natural joy of this bodhicitta. There's a sense of relief. It's like discovering that everything we ever wanted for others and ourselves is already contained in our own hearts. It's like waking from a dream. The longer we relax in this energy, the bigger it gets. Contemplating bodhicitta takes a lot of letting go. When we do this practice, what might come up are hopes and fears about our loved ones, negative thoughts about people whom we don't like, or about painful events. We don't deal with these distractions by overriding them with the pretense of love. As we return to the words, may this one know happiness, or may this one be free of suffering, something deeper than the emotional disturbance tells us that it's okay. We can let the anger dissipate. That something is bodhicitta, expanding. Like the peace we experience in shamatha, this bodhicitta is intrinsic, a natural resting place. However, we must practice becoming familiar with it and train it in making it bigger. As we stabilize ourselves in the warmth and openness of our feeling for our loved ones, we become able to radiate it in a wider arc. Now we make it big enough to include someone with whom we're not quite so close. We can start by wishing for the happiness of a neighbor or an acquaintance. May Jared's friend get the job he wants. We begin to realize that, just like our loved one, this person too deserves our care and kindness. If we feel more daring, we can wish people the root of happiness, which is that they discover their basic goodness. We can wish that they find their way out of bewilderment and suffering. Everyone deserves to be happy. No one deserves to suffer. Thus we extend this feeling to them. We're beginning to see that we have plenty of love and compassion to share. As we generate these feelings, they bring an actual sense of relief. It's like the sun melting a piece of ice in our heart into a warm, inviting pool in which we can bathe. The more we do the practice, the bigger the pool gets, and the more people we can invite in to share it. This wealth is self-sustaining. The more we generate, the more we have. Now we can extend our hearts to people we hardly know, on the street, at the office. We can look in their eyes and see in them that they're just like me, just like my child, just like my mother, my brother, my wife, my husband. We can even extend love and compassion to people we see on television, to people we read about in the newspaper. It may not be my wife or friend, but we all need love. We all need care. It's as if we are on fire with love and care for others. The happiness of others becomes our happiness. It's like inviting someone over for dinner. We make the food, and we're completely engrossed in whether they like it and if they're having a good time. If they're happy, it makes us happy. Now the tender young shoot has grown into an enormous stalk. In generating love and compassion, we've entered the heart of the Buddha, where there is limitless love and compassion for all. It's a free-flowing energy that isn't even particularly ours, and it connects us with everyone, beyond the limitations of personalities and concepts. Now we can bring to mind people whom we don't even like, and radiate the warmth of love and compassion to them. Next, we can extend bodhicitta to all sentient beings. We can use the aspiration, "May all sentient beings experience happiness," or "May all sentient beings be free from suffering," and rest there in the middle of an enormous circle of fire that is burning so brightly that we no longer feel separate from any of them. This is the power of bodhicitta, the great mind of enlightenment. It is the mind of the bodhisattva warrior, who can care for all things infinitely. When we get up from our meditation session, we can keep the fire in our heart burning. We can carry that warmth, that intention to care for the well-being of others, into every moment of our lives. When we do that, we are more awake to our enlightened qualities immediately. We're riding on Wind Horse, the energy of basic goodness that has been ours from beginningless time. If we are diligent in generating love and compassion, at some point it will spontaneously arise in any situation. It's like jumping into the heart of enlightenment, which is the same as our own heart. When we awaken the heart of enlightenment, it's not simply what we have, it is what we are. If we spend part of the morning and part of the evening generating bodhicitta, we can reflect back on our day and feel genuinely good that we did something worthwhile. We were courageous enough to take time out of the me schedule to think of others. In order for our mind to do that, it has to come out of itself. It has to be less preoccupied with its own concerns. It has to stretch just a little bit. In doing this, we're actually extending love and compassion to ourselves as well. It's not that we have to think about every single other person on the planet all the time. Rousing bodhicitta means that we're actively engaging in thoughts of both self and other, in subject and object. Just by thinking beyond me, we're recycling. We're giving something back to the earth and to the world. Just by thinking, "May she be happy," rather than "May I be happy," we've begun to change the structure of our life, and to a certain degree, the structure of the whole world. There are so many people on earth. How many of us are sitting on a cushion with a calm mind, generating love and compassion in our being? How many of us even know that we can do this? Even if we know, how many of us make time to do it? When we generate this mind of enlightenment, we discover that it produces happiness and peace in ourselves. contemplating, thinking about, and generating bodhicitta is a sure way to be happy, to be at peace. Having kindness and compassion in the face of suffering leads to the genuine desire to achieve enlightenment. That's why happiness is known as virtue in the Shambhala Buddhist tradition. Because what virtue produces is more virtue. And how we experience virtue is happiness. Part 4. Warrior in the World. 19. Rousing Motivation. The Tibetan word for motivation is kunlong. It means to rise above, to come up. Rousing our motivation by making it bigger is how we rise above samsara. It takes courage to make our motivation bigger. The first step in expanding our motivation is to stop and notice what we're doing. We can start by asking, what's the point of my life? Its genuine meaning. What is my motivation in living this life? The more we contemplate motivation, the more potent and powerful a force it becomes. Traditionally, there are a few different levels of motivation by which we might live. These motivations are the natural development of our human potential. The first motivation is to take care of our material needs. This is a common sense motivation. We need to eat, dress, and stay warm. It's good to take care of our family and ourselves. If this is our only motivation, however, we're not fulfilling our human potential. The second motivation is slightly broader. We combine our worldly aims with spiritual practice. Many practitioners in our culture are motivated by worldly concerns and use spirituality to successfully accomplish their wishes. It's fine to use spiritual practice to get what we want. People have always made offerings to the gods in order to ensure a plentiful harvest. It should be clear, however, that at the heart of this motivation lies the desire to please ourselves. The danger of this motivation is that we can trick ourselves into thinking that we're becoming less worldly when what we're really doing is distorting practice to fortify our comfort zone. This is a common pitfall, not a crime. My father often taught about cutting through spiritual materialism. This means cutting through our attempts to use spirituality to feed our solid self. The Buddha also taught that stability, the peace that comes through meditation, can become just as much a trap as any old desire. We can create a Goldilocks zone out of our practice and hide there. We can become spiritual junkies, motivated only by what makes us feel good. So much of what passes as spirituality these days is really about pleasure-seeking, getting high. This self-absorption disguised as spirituality only leads to more suffering. Real spirituality is about getting grounded. Once we understand who we are, we can realize the needs of others and do something about helping them. Being grounded in who we are is known as basic goodness. Our motivation stretches further when we begin to think about how our current actions might affect us after death. This larger motivation comes from seeing the vast interconnection of cause and effect, and the fact that our present activities directly affect what will happen to us in the future. With this motivation, we practice spiritual teachings to assure a favorable afterlife or rebirth, depending on our beliefs. In traditional Buddhist cultures, people are motivated by the desire to accumulate merit. Merit is like a series of domino chain reactions that enable positive results in this and future lifetimes. Tibetan nomads go on long religious pilgrimages, sometimes prostrating themselves for months on end across vast, desolate plains and mountain ranges. They do this to show their heartfelt devotion for the living teachings of the Buddha. But underneath their activity lies the motivation to do something now that will lead to larger future happiness. Traveling in Tibet, I was so touched by the devotion of the nomadic people. Everyone makes offerings to the local monastery. People with almost no money give generously to teachers and monks. Whenever I was staying in a monastery, village people would line up for hours, pushing and shoving to be able to offer what little they had. People also spend their time carving mantras on stones and circumambulating sacred places. While meditating and making offerings is the foundation of their culture, their real motivation is to make things work out well for themselves later. They are less focused on me right now, and more interested in how they can prepare for death as well as rebirth. They know that attaining personal enlightenment can take many lifetimes, so they're setting themselves up with meritorious activity in order to establish conditions for a favorable rebirth and ultimate enlightenment. In Buddhist terms, this would mean being born human under circumstances in which we can hear and practice the Dharma. This motivation is yet a larger version of the have a nice day approach. We're trying to get everything in order and make it work out in the long run. We want our nice day to last longer. In the next, larger motivation, we see clearly that the chain reaction of causes and conditions that dominate our world is cyclical, endless, and fundamentally dissatisfying. Perhaps we've struggled through one relationship after another, or we have continual problems with our family or at work. Something opens our eyes to the depth of bewilderment and the darkness of samsara. We see that pain, suffering, impermanence, and death are the facts of life. When we enter into this larger motivation, we break out of thinking that we can get what we want from the circle of suffering. We see its endless quality, and we want the giant wheel to stop. Our motivation here is to break out of the cycle and seek freedom from suffering. All these motivations are considered small because they center on our own happiness, as opposed to the happiness of others. However, each one is slightly larger than the one before, because its perspective is bigger. What marks the border between small motivation and great motivation is a shift in focus from our own happiness to that of others. Using our lives to bring benefit to others is considered a great motivation. Having this motivation of the warrior bodhisattva is how we generate bodhicitta. Bodhicitta is the best mind we have, and rousing the courage to live from it is the greatest motivation there is. It's this motivation that leads to enlightenment. Knowing why we suffer, knowing that there's something we can do about it, leads us to dedicate our life to the service of others who suffer just as we do. Having already understood our own suffering, we are no longer fearful of it. We have the courage to extend genuine compassion to others, not because we think we're better than they are, but because we know we're all the same. We know that, just like us, they have basic goodness. We know that, just like us, they suffer because they don't know their own wealth. We know that, just like us, they could awaken the mind of enlightenment by rousing bodhicitta. This gives birth to greater compassion. The more confident we become in our own natural state, the more we want to help others see theirs. This wisdom becomes the sun within our hearts, and compassion becomes the moon that shines down. This is the motivation of an enlightened being, the motivation that has no boundaries and extends as far as the mind itself. Bringing benefit to others could take many forms, but the ultimate benefit is to help others awaken from bewilderment and suffering by helping them see their basic goodness. We take the welfare of all beings to be our responsibility and strive for unsurpassed enlightenment as the means to bring about the same enlightenment in others. We're so intimate with the roots of bewilderment and suffering that we cannot help but feel love and compassion for everyone. We would go to the ends of the earth to alleviate the suffering of others. We would work for the benefit of others for thousands and thousands of endless lifetimes. Even though we may not believe that there are many lifetimes, our courage is that big. We have that kind of fortitude and visionary perspective. This is the way of a warrior bodhisattva, a being inspired to attain enlightenment. Obviously, it's a worthy motivation, but it's important to be honest with ourselves and to start where we are. We need the ground beneath our feet in order to walk farther. We can expand our motivation gradually. That's the point of becoming familiar with our motivation and beginning to rouse it. We do this by contemplating it. Contemplating motivation requires the willingness to slow down, open up, and tune into our life. What's going on right now? What's propelling us? Our motivation changes from day to day. Once we're aware that we have a motivation, we can always make it bigger. Even when we're feeling stressed or overwhelmed, we can practice rousing it as a way to open our heart beyond our own suffering, to relax into the bodhicitta that connects us all. In contemplating our motivation, we see that sometimes we're stuck in our hard, tightly closed mind. What will pull us out of our slump? Sometimes loosening up by taking a shower or a walk or a rest might be the way to open into a larger motivation. Perhaps we do some yoga or meditate for a few minutes in order to feel better, a little stronger. At some point we might see that getting comfortable cheers us up, but only for a little while. That's a glimpse of renunciation. Then our heart might soften a little as we think of our friend who was in a car accident and can't do yoga anymore. Compassion arises in our mind stream, and we're no longer just thinking about our own well-being. Our heart and mind have softened and grown just by caring for another. We have entered into the courageous motivation of awakened heart. We each have the potential to ally our minds with this vast motivation. It requires knowing our own strength, which is why we meditate. We can soften and open ourselves beyond our tight circle in order to live life big. Taking this journey requires discipline, diligence, and fortitude. But like all journeys, it starts with one step. Try it. Tomorrow morning when you open your eyes, sit up in bed, take a deep breath, and ask yourself, okay, what does my mind feel like? How am I going to approach this day? What's driving me? Bring to mind some of the different motivations. Contemplate your motivation for a few seconds or as a 5 or 10 minute ritual that begins your day. Every human being already has a motivation. You have an opportunity to get to know yours and to turn your mind to the motivation of the warrior bodhisattva. The good news is that awakened heart is in harmony with the vast motivation. In fact, it is vast motivation. The mind of enlightenment is naturally big and open, caring and kind. It is only the discursiveness of our wild horse mind and the baggage of our solid sense of self that keeps us feeling small and claustrophobic. True happiness is opening the mind of enlightenment. How do we get from here to there? By rousing motivation. Our motivation is what paves the path from bewilderment and suffering to wisdom. 20. Wisdom and emptiness. I spend a lot of time studying traditional text on Buddhism. Studying is a deep exercise in understanding the teachings, and in a way, it's like a strategy game that requires always being on the ball. I'll be reading along as some ancient master is describing his understanding of a topic like meditation. He is commenting on how to practice, what the mind should be like, what kind of motivation to have, and so forth. I'll be thinking, this sounds really good. Then at the end of the chapter I read, by the way, this isn't the whole picture. And the text proceeds to describe in detail how all that was just said is only relatively true. There is always farther to go on the spiritual path. We think that we've arrived at a place that is really it, but then something pulls the rug out from under us, pushing us beyond that view into a deeper insight. It never quite works to build a comfort zone out of meditation. If we're meditating properly, our practice and understanding will always take us a little further than we might think we want to go. By resting in the true meaning of our contemplation, we're becoming familiar with our own wisdom. We're beginning to see reality as it is. Just as we open our perspective beyond what we ever thought it could be, our wisdom thrusts us into yet a vaster world. This is how we keep moving on the path. At each stage of contemplative meditation, we're encountering a deeper level of knowing. The aspect of the mind that knows its own actions is shishin, awareness, presently knowing. Our mind is always subject to being distracted by thoughts of what happened in the past and ideas of what could happen in the future. But the living experience is what is happening now. The mind comes in and out of existence on a momentary basis, and thus the ability to know also comes in and out of existence on a momentary basis. Now is a fleeting moment, but it is knowable. It's a moment of freshness, a full involvement in the immediate present. Meditation trains us in the awesome power of the mind to be completely present with what is happening now. Awareness gives us the ability to know what we're doing, and insight, vipassana, gives us the ability to penetrate it. We're no longer simply sauntering through or slipping by or spacing out, unaware of our own lives. The power of awareness tells us how the mind feels, what it's experiencing, the quality of our meditation, and how we're conducting it. It notices the transitory and illusory nature of thoughts, emotions, and concepts. Insight is the higher view that draws conclusions about what awareness sees. It penetrates phenomena, our mind, confusion, all that we encounter, and sees its true nature, its meaning. At this point, an amazing transformation takes place. The simple act of awareness, combined with the reflective capacity of insight, begins to develop a deeper element called prajna. Prajna is the mind's natural intelligence. The word means best knowledge, highest knowledge, most sublime knowledge. It's the ability to know what is. In contemplating concepts like impermanence, the precious opportunity of being born human, and bodhicitta, we use conceptual understanding to open the doorway to our wisdom. To understand the truth of reality, we have to have a mind that is not completely overwhelmed by prefabricated patterns and has roused the motivation to be truly compassionate in its quest. Our understanding is continuous and cumulative. We keep having little insights about the nature of reality, and they build upon each other. For example, the pain we feel when we hold on to our solid sense of self, and the joy we feel when we rest in our natural state, opens the door into compassion for the suffering of others. Our relative wisdom, causal prajna, takes us beyond the concept of me, directly into the reality of our experience. It creates the conditions for the final result, which is non-conceptual understanding. What is non-conceptual understanding? It's the intuitive insight that knows the truth directly, not through reason or logic, but beyond the realm of thought. Let's say we've never seen the moon. Hearing about it paints a conceptual picture in our mind. Someone draws a moon in the sand for us, and this makes it more concrete, but it's still only an idea. Then one night we see the moon reflected in water. Though this image seems closer to the truth, we still don't know the moon itself. Finally, someone points to the sky and we see the moon directly. Now we know the moon. It's said that seeing is believing, yet non-conceptual understanding is beyond belief. The moon itself is beyond the words, the picture, the reflection, and the finger. This is where prajna takes us. Beyond. true reality is without concept, beyond the duality of this and that. True prajna, true knowledge, is direct experience. It's knowing without the filter of self. Direct experience is wisdom itself, unborn, unceasing, neither still nor moving. It's prajna that will take us beyond conceptual mind to discover basic goodness, step by step. It's prajna that will give us a glimpse into the totality of the heart of the universe, which is of the same nature as our own. Through prajna we discover that there is no physical cohesion to what we see. Yet appearances continue to arise. Our passion arises. What makes up the object of our desire? The very thing that hooks us, a feeling, a meal, or another person, is made of parts. And those parts can be broken down infinitely. When we look for a solid self, where is it? Is it in our feelings? Meditation has shown us how effervescent these are. Is it in our body? Then where? In the arms, the legs, the head, the heart? We can't find the self in any of these forms. Even if we come to the conclusion that we're all these parts, they don't hold together as a solid self. There's something more than form to us. There's also consciousness. Consciousness comes in many forms. It also is not solid. There's a consciousness associated with sight, with sound, with taste, with touch, with smell. That's how we know what we perceive. We also have a mental consciousness, within which we have memories, ideas, and dreams. These memories, thoughts, and dreams are based on sense perceptions. These sense perceptions are how we know form. And with prajna, we understand that those forms are not solid. One of the more provocative Buddhist teachings puts it this way. Form is emptiness. Emptiness also is form. Our investigation begins to show us that me, which at first seems so solid, isn't solid at all. When we disassemble it, we can't find anything. Seeing the reality of no self is a preliminary understanding of profound emptiness. Yet all the same, we do perceive a self, and the world also appears to be quite real. Someone asked the Buddha about this. If there's no self, who's this talking to you here, and what's this world I see? He replied, what you see are skanda, heaps, aggregates. They are form, feeling, perception, mental formation, and consciousness. He placed rice on the ground and said, the self is like this pile of rice. When you look at it, it seems to be one whole entity. When you look closer, it breaks down into grains of rice. And those grains of rice can be broken down still further. Thus, things appear to have form. Yet they are empty of form. Contemplating the Buddha's words may just give us a small glimpse of emptiness, based on a conception. We may not believe what we see, but a seed of understanding is planted. This loosens up our solid sense of self. That's the beginning of prajna, the beginning of the mind being able to truly see what's happening. Prajna needs our involvement and our inquisitiveness. We may not experience ourselves as emptiness, but after contemplating it for a while, it's possible to come to the conclusion that, yes, there is really no me. This is how prajna begins to make sense of who we are, or are not, and of our environment as well. It is said that at the time of death, this profound understanding dawns on us naturally because we feel our bodies falling apart, yet our consciousness remains and is able to know. All that was me has gone off in the 10 directions. But if we contemplate the truth of emptiness now, we don't have to wait until that particular moment to discover it. Meditation is how we prepare ourselves for death and for life. Meditation is a process of becoming comfortable with our own wisdom, which is direct experience of the ultimate truth. For a very long time, we've held the view that things exist and are real. When we begin to really look at things, when we start to break things down to a minute level, we see that there's nothing inherent. We can look as much as we want, but we'll never find anything that is solidly here. The ultimate truth is emptiness, suchness, in Sanskrit, shunyata. Emptiness is at the base of all that we experience. That's not to say that nothing exists on a relative level. Rather, there's an all-pervasive quality that something doesn't seem quite right. And that quality is emptiness. We mustn't be misled into thinking that emptiness is nihilism or non-existence, because this emptiness transcends existence and non-existence, both and neither. This is known as Tashi Chotel, freedom from the four extremes. This emptiness is inseparable from the wisdom inherent in our own mind. This emptiness of our wisdom mind has radiance. Thus, the nature of wisdom mind is known as luminosity emptiness. In the same way, the sun shines inseparably from the empty space it inhabits. This suchness is the nature of all. It is basic goodness, simply what is. This is how an enlightened being experiences the world. Everything is inseparable luminosity and emptiness, whether we see it clearly or not. Prajna awakens the potential to see it directly, and this gives rise to great joy or bliss. Prajna is where view and meditation meet. The view is our understanding, and practice is how we make it our own. In the same way, the sun shines inseparably from the empty space it inhabits. If we want to begin to understand emptiness, we contemplate the self and try to find it. It isn't that we vault from taming the mind to contemplation into non-conceptual emptiness. We don't pledge our allegiances to the Buddha and prepare to jump. It's a gentle transition. Practicing shamatha has made our mind subtle and supple enough to understand these profound truths. The more we practice, the more we realize that the rock we're standing on, the fabricated self, is far from solid. Through practice and understanding, the rock begins dissolving. In discovering emptiness, we're not leaping anywhere. Practice wears away the rock, like water dripping for eons. By the time we see what's happening, we've overcome our fear of falling off. We know the suffering caused by the simple misunderstanding that there was something to stand on. We want to practice to wear away the illusion of a self. Of course, keeping a grip on ourselves is an old and very deeply rooted pattern. It takes ongoing courage and hard labor to give it up. The fact of the matter is, however, that whether we hold on to it or give it up, the self has never existed. It's like a mirage. Within samsara, we're never going to find true existence, nor will we find it in nirvana. As long as we invest in this illusion, it's never going to be a perfect day. Something's always going to go wrong. The pleasure we hope for is always turning into the pain we fear. Wisdom, on the other hand, is free from change. Prajna is how we become familiar with the true nature of reality. We see that samsara is not a place, but a mistaken view, a way of freezing reality into a concept. We see how this pattern has led to our own suffering. We feel compassion because it's clear that everyone suffers from the same delusion, and it causes so much pain. This wisdom and compassion can lead to full enlightenment, full awakening from this dreamlike existence, complete knowledge and understanding of who and where we are, or are not. Experiencing the true nature of reality brings great joy. Raptu Gawa. Directly seeing this suchness, we know that enlightenment is possible. We've climbed to the top of the hill and peeked over, and we see a beautiful lake and a meadow. We look back and see that others are struggling very hard up the hill.